I'm Scott Lamar. Mass shootings in El Paso, Texas and Dayton, Ohio, a day apart last August, left 31 people dead and another 41 injured. Unfortunately, mass shootings occur year after year. As often happens, after the El Paso and Dayton shootings, there were discussions and debates about the availability of guns and mental health. On Smart Talk, we decided to examine mass shootings and guns in a different way, by talking to people from institutions that have researched how to reduce gun violence and another one that has studied mass shooters. It makes our list for top stories of 2019. The Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research has studied gun violence and gun laws and has data on what can help reduce gun violence and what doesn't. Joining us today is Dr. Cassandra Crafossi, Deputy Director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research. Dr. Crafossi, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So would universal background checks reduce gun violence, Dr. Crafossi?
Universal background checks are a really important foundation for any functioning gun laws. If we don't have background checks for every gun sale, it's hard to enforce laws that we have. So for example, if a state had a minimum age law but no universal background check requirement, private sales become an easy way for people to skirt around other laws. However, by themselves, they're not sufficient to reduce gun violence. There are accountability issues and reporting issues that can make that system not as effective as it should be. In contrast, if you pair a background check system with a purchaser licensing requirement, that's really when we start to see protective and public safety benefits.
So if we were to just call it as it is, background checks, universal background checks on their own are not as effective as licensing. Is that what you're saying?
Correct. So the most rigorous research done looking at background checks by themselves versus states that have implemented a licensing system, we see that background checks don't do enough to reduce gun violence, while licensing systems, these states experience lower rates of firearm homicide and firearm suicide.
And suicide, too. That was my next question. So it's not just homicide. The data shows that there are fewer suicides committed with guns as well.
Correct, because licensing systems provide a more rigorous opportunity for law enforcement to identify and screen out potentially prohibited people. They could be prohibited for criminal activity or perhaps a mental health issue. Importantly, licensing also provides what we think of as a built-in waiting period, where the process of applying for a permit may delay acquisition of a firearm that could be used to harm oneself or others.
So, as you mentioned, there are other states that do require gun owners to be licensed or have permits. What exactly is the process? How would you describe that process to go about getting licensed?
Sure. So currently, 9 states and the District of Columbia require all prospective handgun purchasers to apply for and obtain a license. There's a little bit of variation across the states, but the core components are an application to state or local law enforcement and more time to conduct a background check. Currently, federal law only allows for 3 days, and if a background check doesn't come back completed in that time, the default is the seller can complete that sale, even if the person might be prohibited. In contrast, these licensing states often give as many as 30 days for law enforcement to complete that check. Most of these licensing states also have a fingerprinting component, which provides a better opportunity to identify individuals. So if you compare it to occupational licensing, most of these licensing systems for jobs, you have to submit a fingerprint because there are too many possible errors with a name and birthday check alone. So that fingerprinting component is really important.
As you mentioned, about 10 states, or 9 states, I believe you said, with the District of Columbia. Some of those states, New York, Maryland, but Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia, still have high rates of gun violence. So is there data to back up that licensing gun owners reduces gun violence?
Absolutely. So we've conducted a number of studies that look at some of the downstream effects like homicide and suicide, but we've also looked at the impact of licensing on sources of guns used in crime, like gun homicide, for example. And what we see in states with licensing, the guns that are being used in crime in those states are coming from states with weaker gun laws. The issue in the U.S., we have this patchwork of laws, and we have borders that are porous, so people and products can move freely across them by design, which means that in Maryland and Baltimore, guns can be brought in from Tennessee or Virginia. In Chicago, guns can be brought in from Indiana, etc. And so when we have this patchwork, this sort of weak laws anywhere, it can increase the risk of guns being used in crime anywhere.
The biggest objections to licensing of guns, one is that many gun owners say that it's inconvenient. I mean, especially when you say that you can have to wait up to 30 days after purchasing a gun. But the bigger issue is that there are many gun owners across this country who believe that the government or someone wants to take away their guns, and that licensing guns just provides the information that the government needs to do that, that they'd see it as an intrusion on their privacy. What have you found about that?
Sure. So we've done waves of public opinion polling every 2 years since the Sandy Hook shooting. And one of the questions that we ask is, do you favor or oppose requiring individuals to obtain a license from state or local law enforcement before buying a gun? And overall, across the U.S., 75% of adults support that policy. When you look at gun owners specifically, it's about 62%. So almost two-thirds of gun owners support this policy. Yes, it is a mild inconvenience. I've gone through the process myself. It takes a little bit of time, but at the end of the day, it's only that. It's an inconvenience. It's not prohibiting anyone who is a lawful gun owner from obtaining that firearm. With regard to confiscation, many of these state laws have been on the books for decades. None of these states have created a situation where there's a mass confiscation. So I think it's just a scare tactic to push back against a policy that we know is extremely effective at reducing gun violence.
Another problem with background checks, and by the way, not trying to make these background checks, and I'm sure that Dr. Fossey is not doing that either, to make it sound like this is not a good way to go, not saying it either way, just saying that there are problems with universal background checks, and a lot of people are calling for them today. But those background checks need information to be reported to them from law enforcement, mental health providers, even the military. I remember a few years ago, the Air Force had not reported, I forget how many, hundreds of their members that should not have had guns that had committed crimes. So information is needed before a reliable background check can be provided, correct?
Absolutely. And again, I just want to emphasize your point. Background checks for all sales is a necessary component for all of our other gun laws to function. So even though I'm sort of talking about the benefits of licensing, licensing can, again, only function if you require a background check for all sales. But yeah, there are gaps. There are delays in reporting. There are gaps in reporting. You think about the Sutherland Springs shooting. That was that individual was able to acquire firearms because the military did not properly report records. And I think one of the challenges is that for one reason or another, I don't know for sure what the reason is, people don't seem to take prohibited people obtaining firearms as a serious problem. It seems like, oh, it's okay that 5,000 people who are prohibited gone through this loophole. Oh, it's okay that we're not reporting records. And I feel like the population of the U.S. needs to be calling for improved records. They need to be calling for timely reporting. It's absurd that there are people who are prohibited who are able to obtain firearms even with a background check because these records are not being reported.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Today we're talking about, it's an aftermath of the shootings over the weekend, talking about gun research, what works, what doesn't when it comes to regulations. Our guest today, Dr. Cassandra Crafossi, Deputy Director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's take a call now from Jim in Enola. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, Scott.
Hi, Jim.
I listened to what your guest has to say, and I personally believe and agree with most of what she's saying. The problem is I don't think there's a consensus now for a licensing law beyond possibly for handguns. I think that those of us like me who maybe own guns, I own a rifle, but think that we need to use this as an opportunity to get something done. We need to unite behind three things, and I believe that statistics show there is a consensus for these three things. One is universal background check law, no exception. You buy a gun, you must pass a background check, period. Two, a strong universal red flag law, and your guests can explain what a red flag law is. And three, an absolute ban on civilian use of weapons of war. Now, to me, that would include assault weapons like the AK-47 and those large magazine clips that one of the assaulters used in the most recent shooting. So I think we all need to unite behind those three things if we're really going to make a difference and get something passed. Thanks for taking my call.
All right. Thank you very much, Jim. Do those red flag laws work?
Yeah, so red flag laws, the sort of policy that they're referred to as is extreme risk protection orders. And as you said, they temporarily separate someone who's exhibiting risky behaviors from their firearms. And you can think about it like a domestic violence restraining order. There's due process. Someone petitions the court, there's a hearing, and a judge decides whether or not you should be subject to that order. So there's a court-ordered process that one goes through. And our early evaluation of this data suggests that it's really effective at reducing firearm suicide. So suicide is a leading cause of firearm death. There's over 20,000 people dying of firearm suicide every year in the vast majority of states. Suicide, rather than homicide, is the leading cause of firearm death. And so we do see beneficial impacts of these extreme risk protection orders. And also there's a potential benefit to reduce mass shootings as well. So individuals who are considering mass shootings often have what's called leakage, where they're leaking information to a friend or a family member about what they're considering. And if that's happening, then that can be brought to the court, and that person can be separated from their firearms and not allowed to purchase any more for a temporary period. So that is absolutely a law that we should be considering federally, such that there aren't these gaps like we see across states.
So the other part of Jim's question, assault weapon bans. I guess one of the big arguments against it is, what is an assault weapon? And if we can agree on that, do they work? Do bans work?
Yeah, that's a really great point. So you're correct. Most of the research that was looking at the impact of the federal assault weapon ban had mixed results because of those exemptions. It was easy for gun manufacturers to remove one component of a firearm so that it didn't meet the criteria of an assault weapon, and then they just sold that component as an aftermarket accessory that individuals could then apply to their firearms themselves. We do see potential benefits for banning large capacity magazines. So these, regardless of the type of firearm that's used, large capacity magazines allow for a lot of rounds to be fired very quickly without having to reload. And those can be used in assault style rifles or handguns. And so that could be, in my opinion, a really important place to start, because you can't sell a modified version of a large capacity magazine the way that you could sell a modified version of an assault style rifle. Well, I do think it's important that we restrict access to weapons that can cause a lot of damage and were really designed for war, that if we're going to have them on our streets with civilians, that they undergo a more rigorous screening process for sure. And to the caller's point about handguns, 90% of guns that are used in crime, when we know the type, are handguns. And so much of what we're talking about, at least much of what we talk about at our center, is really focused on restricting access to handguns. 50% of mass shootings are committed with handguns. And so while mass shootings with assault-style rifles certainly catch our attention because there tends to be more individuals shot and killed, it's important to keep handguns in mind when we're talking about policy solutions.
You know, this whole conversation, and I think it's one of the reasons it's so difficult to have this conversation, get people to agree. There seems to be no gray area a lot of time. We hear that term common sense. It's common sense to other people. It's like, well, no, you're trying to take my guns away. Anyway, with that said, we break this down even further. 2% of mass shooting of the murders in this country come during mass shootings, and don't want to downplay that. Obviously, it's horrendous. It's been described as carnage. That's very much true. But it's 2%, and most. And you tell me if this is accurate. But I would assume that most of the homicides committed in this country with a gun are not by legal gun owners, licensed gun owners, or those who have a carry permit, but have been carried out by those who have a gun that they have the gun illegally. They should not have it. Is that true?
So one of the challenges in answering that question is access to data. The closest thing that we can get is surveys of people who have been incarcerated for crimes with a gun. And when you look at that federal data, 60% of people who were incarcerated for a crime with a gun were legal possessors of that gun at the time they committed the crime. So
okay.
It's not exactly accurate to say that all of these crimes are committed by people who couldn't buy firearms, because people are law-abiding citizens until they're not. Something could happen that could trigger a behavior. And so that's why it's important to focus both on regulating acquisition through background checks with licensing, but also dispossessing people who are exhibiting increased risk through these extreme risk protection orders. I think the main takeaway from this whole conversation, there's not one solution. If gun violence had one solution, we would have solved it already. It's going to require a multifaceted approach of multiple policies and multiple public health programs and prevention strategies if we're going to start chipping away at the problem of gun violence in the U.S.
And let's take a few phone calls here. Ed is in Stroudsburg. Ed, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Good morning, Scott. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, you're welcome.
There's so much to unwrap here, but I'll stick to the two issues that I said I was calling about. One is the licensing requirement usually has a cost affiliated with it. A lot of people, if you subscribe that owning a firearm is for self-protection, and in our country today, unfortunately, there are a lot of people who are targeted, people of color, LGBTQ folks, people who are of a certain religious affiliation. And so licensing requirements are usually costly, timely. So if you have someone, maybe a domestic abuse victim, who says, you know what, I'm going to go buy a firearm, I'm going to get trained, I'm going to know how to use it in case this person comes back who has threatened me or maybe has already done me harm, and you take away that ability, that tool for them to potentially save their lives. So it's quite restrictive. The other issue I have with most of the anti-gun viewpoints is that it's all about attacking the tool, which often causes... I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought. But we don't look at root causes. They look at the gun, and they don't look at why are people so violent? Why do these people act out, these young white men who predominantly are the ones who do these mass public shootings? There's racism. There's domestic violence. There's drug and alcohol abuse. There's gangs. And there's the list goes on and on. And I think the reason that it's always a call for, oh, let's ban weapons, is that's cheap. It's cheap and quick and easy, and it makes everybody feel good. But addressing those other issues I listed, they're expensive, and they take time, and they don't stop the problem in the tracks. And I subscribe that and a ban of any kind, first of all, is unconstitutional. Yeah. But
Hey, Ed, I'm going to have to move on. Hey, thank you very much for your call. Dr. Grafassi, what do you think about that?
So I do recognize that there is often a cost applied to the licensing component, although if an individual is going to spend several hundred dollars to acquire a firearm, a little bit more to undergo a thorough background check, I don't think is unreasonable, particularly because many of these licenses last over several years. And if you break out the cost over years, we're talking about, you know, as little as $10 a year for a system to make sure that people are not prohibited. In terms of the comment about attacking the tool, I think what it comes down to is in other countries, we have the same violent video games. We have the same issues with mental health and bullying. We have the same kind of hatred that's being spewed. But we have far greater access to firearms than any of these other countries, which results in us having far greater firearm deaths. Our rate of firearm death in this country is 25 times higher than other economically comparable countries. And so we do need to be talking about these root causes, education and mental health and economic opportunities. But we also, if we simply only look at those, we are ignoring one of the core issues in the U.S., which is access to firearms. That doesn't mean we ban them. We just need to make sure that only the right people who we've recognized are not prohibited can gain access to them.
Let's take a phone call from Gary in Williamstown. Gary, you're on the air.
Thank you. First of all, Scott, I wanted to comment that it doesn't seem like there's a lot of balance on your program. You have one person from an anti-gun organization and no one to speak for the other side.
Well, let me just interrupt you right there because I anticipated someone calling in. We will ask that question, but I don't think this is an anti-gun organization. This is an organization that researches using data. And I go ahead. Now, I just wanted to point that out.
And who funds that organization? You know, the organizations that produce studies many times are trying to reflect the values of their donors. And I just don't believe that Johns Hopkins is a really fair and unbiased organization in this issue. And the other thing I wanted to say is that the right to keep and bear arms in this country is a constitutional right. Since when do we license constitutional rights?
Mm-hmm. Hey, thank you very much for your call, Gary. And Dr. Fossey, I know you face this question often. I have read some of the comments that newspaper articles that I've read where you have been quoted. So let's ask the question that Gary asked. Where does Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence and Center for Gun Policy and Research get its funding?
Yeah, I'm happy to answer that question, but first I just want to point out, in case it wasn't clear in what I was speaking earlier, I am a gun owner. I've been a longtime gun owner. My husband and I own guns. We have them in the home. I grew up in a home with an Army veteran and always had guns in the home, so I am not anti-gun. I am about promoting reasonable evidence-based policies to reduce gun violence. So our center was actually started with a grant from the Joyce Foundation, which is based in Chicago. Over the last 25 years, we've received a number of grants, including grants from the Bureau of Justice Assistance and Smart Policing Initiatives, grants from the Abel and Casey Foundation here in Baltimore. Yes, we have received grants from Bloomberg Philanthropies, but also the Packard Foundation. So it's incorrect to say that we are funded solely by Bloomberg, even though our school is named after Michael Bloomberg and he gave a generous gift to the school. We compete for grants just like everyone else, and we have a broad range of funding sources.
Mm. You face that all the time, and I go back to why it is so difficult to, I don't know, solve this issue or address this issue, because there always is that accusation of, okay, what's your agenda here?
Yeah, that can be very challenging. Often, you know, we spend our time rather than focused on the problem or focused on the research, we're fielding questions about sort of what our secret agenda is. And, you know, I have Mike Bloomberg on speed dial on my phone, and he's personally funding everything. I wish my job would be a lot easier if I didn't have to write all these grants all the time. But I do think, to the caller's point about the Constitution and the right to keep and bear arms, yes, there is a constitutional right for individuals to have guns, but that right is not absolute. We have states with licensing laws right now that have been in place for decades that have not been said to infringe upon the Second Amendment. It does not prevent anyone who is not prohibited from obtaining a firearm. It just provides a screening process to make sure that the folks who shouldn't have guns don't get them.
We're running out of time for this segment of the program, Dr. Crafazzi. One thing I did want to ask, there's been a lot of talk here, and in Pennsylvania we recently have enacted a law about those who are involved in domestic violence situations and having their guns removed. Also have seen some research that shows that many of the mass shooters, many of those who have committed murders, have domestic violence in their background. Do those laws work that would remove firearms from those who have been convicted or have have been accused of domestic violence?
One of the greatest predictors of perpetrating future violence is having perpetrated violence in the past or actually also being a victim of violence. And so that's one of the reasons that federal law prohibits gun ownership among people who are convicted of a domestic violence misdemeanor. And states have recognized that there are some gaps in those laws. So, for example, federal law doesn't apply to dating partners and it doesn't apply to temporary orders. So some states who have strengthen those domestic violence restraining orders have seen protective effects against intimate partner homicide. But you're right, there is a strong connection between domestic violence and mass shootings. Often, mass shootings are not random. They're committed because of a connection to a person or a place. And we see mass shootings happening because a perpetrator of domestic violence is attempting to gain access to their partner. And also, again, just that history of violent behavior. So these domestic violence restraining orders that can dispossess abusers are really important, but also these extreme risk protection orders when there are weaknesses in domestic violence laws in states, these red flag laws or extreme risk protection orders can fill that gap and take guns away from people who are exhibiting dangerous behavior temporarily. Remove firearms.
Dr. Cassandra Crafazzi is a deputy director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research. Dr. Crafazzi, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. During this portion of today's program, we're talking about the welfare of Pennsylvania's children with Kerry King, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Partnerships for Children. Let's get back to early childhood education. As I said earlier, this is something that I think that, and there's research to back this up, as you mentioned, that there are a lot of people who realize that the earlier a child, pre-K in particular, before a child actually gets to kindergarten, that these kind of programs have benefits long-term, well down the line, maybe for a child's entire life. Problem being is that, first of all, there may not be enough programs. Number two, paying for some of those programs, especially for some of those low-income families that you mentioned. What do we do about that? What's being done about that?
Yeah, this is really an area where I think policymakers should be applauded for the work that they have done over the past several years in the state. So both, you know, we were just talking about home visiting and through our work in Childhood Begins at Home, the coalition that we work in, both in that front and in pre-K. So we are leading an effort in that campaign. It's called the Pre-K for PA campaign. So in the past 10 years or so, policymakers in Pennsylvania have been directing funds for access to high-quality pre-K, especially for eligible children. So really, we're focusing at the most at-risk children. And since that time, they have, and I think it's really important to note, if you think about the past 10 years, it's been economically a pretty turbulent time. So when you think of it through that lens, to note that policymakers have still been able to realize how important it is to invest in 3 and 4 year olds before they enter kindergarten, I think it just makes it that much more laudable that they've been able to invest to the extent that they have.
But what does child get out of pre-K at 3 and 4 years old?
Sure. So the research that is out there shows that, it's really twofold. So early on when they enter kindergarten, they are much more ready to really attack the curriculum. So they're ready in terms of early literacy, early numeracy, all the way. So really kind of more on the academic side of things. And then also, and this is where research is a little bit more focused more recently on the social and emotional side of things. And by that, I mean things like behavioral norms. So they know how to follow rules. They know how to listen to directions. And in terms of how that operates in the classroom, it means for a kindergarten teacher, and we actually just did a report in May where we partnered with kindergarten teachers throughout the state where we did a survey to say, you're seeing these kids come in your door, and what are the differences between the children that have been in pre-K versus those who haven't? And they've really reaffirmed what the research has shown, where there are fewer disruptions. And when children are there and know how to follow the rules, know the expectations, it means that more time can be spent on learning and on the academic pieces. So there's that kind of immediate benefit, but then there's also the longer term returns. And on that front, it really goes to less grade repetition. There's a greater return in terms of children graduating on time, and then even into adulthood. You mentioned the Secretary of the Department of Corrections. He's been a great champion for early learning.
John Watson, yeah.
Exactly. So he sees it firsthand, where you have these children that might otherwise end up in the criminal justice system, and because policymakers and others have seen the benefit of investing early on, they're productive citizens rather being in prison, honestly.
One thing, though, I have heard over the years when talking about this issue is that just putting a child in pre-K, what some people may consider daycare even, is not solving the problem, that it has to be quality pre-K, mm-hmm. which probably cost a little bit more. Then we get back to the money part of it. Mm-hmm. Where does the money come from?
Mm-hmm. And so it definitely hits home with me. So I'm the parent of a 4-year-old and an 18-month-old. And so I can personally attest, yes, it is there. And there is a marked difference where they're in a high-quality pre-K program, there is a set standard with a curriculum, with the professional development and education requirements of the teachers in the program. And I've seen it firsthand with my 4-year-old son. So you can see the benefits of that high quality
standard.
Meaning
that your son went somewhere that wasn't as high quality?
No, he is in a high quality. Okay. Pennsylvania has a high quality rating system. Mm-hmm. We call it the Keystone Stars system, and he's in a high quality program, a 4-star program. And I can see the benefits where he'll come home and talk about, he'll use vocabulary. Like the other day, he said, "What's your theory on this?" And I said to my husband, I said, "Where did he learn that?" So things like that, where it's like he didn't learn that from us. So you can definitely tell when we talk about high quality, there is a definite backing and a set of standards that are there. But you're right, there is an associated cost with that, and that's where we do rely on state investments, and that gets back to where policymakers have realized that. And since Governor Wolf has come into office, we've seen about $145 million in investments in high-quality pre-K, which is pretty amazing. In the budget that just passed, there was a $30 million increase for high-quality pre-K, which will benefit about 2,600 kids. Pretty much in a few weeks, when the school year starts, 2,600 more kids will have access to pre-K.
It's only 2,600.
Exactly. So that just speaks to, currently about 56% of eligible kids are still not enrolled. So while we've made great progress, there's still more work that has to be done. And that's why we continue our work advocating in Harrisburg on why more investments need to be made.
Want to transition to K through 12 education, mm-hmm. and this is where we really get into a discussion. There are a lot of discussions that we can have, but when we talk about the amount of money that is being spent, basic education funding during the Wolf administration has increased every year, mm-hmm. With the help of the legislature, I will add, and so that's a good thing. But I know that, you know, one of the biggest criticisms, and I have even seen it from your organization, is that Pennsylvania funding, school funding, is so lopsided, mm-hmm. For lack of a better word. It's unequal. It's not equitable. Now, we have a formula, but it may be years before we get to that equity. In fact, they admit it will be. What do we do right now? Because we have school districts that are spending money per pupil that is probably above the average, what they should, or what they're told they should. And there are many others that are well below.
Mm-hmm. It really comes down to the balance between state support versus local support. And the, you know, Pennsylvania has a lot of variance. You know, it's the difference between Montgomery County and Elk County. So there's a lot of variation across the state. And, you know, we've been appreciative of the support that's gone into basic education funding. We realize more needs to happen. But I think that's where, in our partnership in the PA Schools Work Coalition, we're also trying to identify other areas where, while we're trying to drive as much funds as possible into basic education funding, where else can we support school districts? And that's where we've started to focus more on career and technical education. And we released a report this year specifically on CTE, or career and technical education. And state support for CTE has really not been present over the past several years. That has changed in the past two state budgets. And this state budget allocated $10 million for career and technical education, which we were thrilled to see. And really what that means is being able to send kids to career and technical education programs, or when I was in high school, we called them the VOTEC centers.
Right.
So they're now career and technical education centers. And what we're seeing is there's such a demand for these programs. And there's really been a kind of a shift in a paradigm where you see not every kid has to go to a four-year college. And a lot of, you know, high-paying occupations and family-sustaining jobs really can be achieved through going to a career and technical education program. So when we really started to dig into the data and see that some kids still don't have access to these programs, and it largely is from the cost and the lack of state support, we really identified that as a core issue that we should be advocating for. So the realization of that $10 million in the state budget was a great success for us.
Carrie, we only have about a minute left, and so many topics to discuss when we're talking about children. Health is another area of priority for Pennsylvania Partnerships for Children. And as I'm looking down through your policy goals, lead exposure, identifying children who have been exposed to lead, and we only have less than a minute, is one of your priorities, mm-hmm. correct?
This is a new area of work for us, and it's been pretty shocking. Everybody thinks about Flint, Michigan.
Right.
And what a lot of folks don't realize is Pennsylvania has an extremely old housing stock and is a great risk for lead exposure for children. The expectation is that children are screened twice for lead before their second birthday, and quite frankly, it's not happening. So we're just in the beginning phases of work to make sure that children are screened twice before their second birthday, because really when you're exposed to lead, the effects are irreversible. So eventually we're going to have to get to the abatement phase too.
Carrie King is the president and CEO of the Pennsylvania Partnerships for Children. Carrie, I'm sure we'll have you back on the program again. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right. Now, I'm about to make a transition, and I'll be honest, it is a hard turn. Obviously, there's been a lot of attention focused on the mass shootings that America has experienced over the last couple weeks. And I had an opportunity earlier this week to speak with someone from the Violence Project, which has researched mass shooters going back to 1966. And you'll be able to hear that conversation coming up right here. After mass shootings like those in Gilroy, California, El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio in the last 2.5 weeks, questions are asked like, who was the shooter? Did he express animosity toward the people he targeted or the location where the shooting took place? What was the shooter's background? How and where did he get the firearms he used to carry out the shooting? Usually after a shooting, that information is reported by investigators and the media. However, there is a database of every mass shooter that goes back to 1966. It is compiled and maintained by the Violence Project. One of the people who runs the Violence Project is Dr. Jillian Peterson, a psychologist and professor of criminology and criminal justice at Hamline University in St. Paul, Minnesota. Dr. Peterson, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
First of all, tell us about the Violence Project. What is it?
The Violence Project, we're a nonpartisan think tank. It's run by myself, a psychologist, and my colleague James Densley, who's a sociologist. And the idea is to use research and data to prevent violence, so to make policy decisions based on data and facts.
You're funded by the National Institute of Justice. Who is the National Institute of Justice?
That is the research arm of the U.S. Department of Justice. Yeah, they put out a call for proposals. It's been a couple years now, research specifically looking at mass violence and mass violence prevention and firearm death prevention. And I think they gave out 4 or 5 grants, and we happen to be one of them.
How would you define mass shooting?
So it's actually a really difficult question, and we are using 2 definitions. So for the database that goes back to 1966, we're using the definition of 4 or more people killed. And that's been kind of a standard definition that the FBI uses and that a lot of people have been using. However, it's a pretty limiting definition. So if 3 people die or if 1 person dies but 30 people get shot, they wouldn't fall into that definition. So we are also creating some additional databases going back just 20 years to 1999, where we are looking at any time an person intended to commit a mass shooting. And for that one, we're using they came in heavily armed with the goal of firing indiscriminately, or they shot more than 1 person.
In my introduction, I said he when listing the questions asked after the shootings. It's almost always men and mostly white men who have committed this mass shootings, correct?
Yep. So our database shows 98% men, and we're about 60% white.
60% may surprise some people because a lot of people have gone as far as saying it's almost always white men. Now, your data shows that mass shooters have 4 commonalities. What do they all have in common?
So what we're seeing, you know, everybody has their different trajectory, but we saw 4 main themes emerge from the data. The first being early childhood trauma. The second being a crisis point where something really pushes them over the edge and they become suicidal. The third being validation for their specific ideas and kind of a script for this form of violence. And then the fourth being the means and ability to carry it out.
All right, so let's talk about this 4, expand our conversation a little bit about them specifically. Childhood trauma, there are many, many people who experience childhood trauma. What kind of trauma are we talking about?
We're seeing all different things, things like parental suicide, physical abuse, sexual abuse, and of course, you know, 99.99% of people who experience childhood trauma would never do something like this. We just know it's one piece of this complex story. So specifically, young boys experiencing early childhood trauma seems to be where the pathway starts.
Moving on to another characteristic of those who have committed mass shootings, an identifiable crisis point in the time before the shooting took place. They were angry over something. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so what we see is individuals that they've been through childhood trauma. This is often a precursor for some mental health concerns. Things are kind of spiraling downward. But then there's one thing that is kind of the final straw. And for school shooters, it's oftentimes something that happened at school or in the family. For workplace shooters, it's often losing their job or being suspended. For other people, it's the breakup of a relationship. But something happens. It's usually a loss that pushes them over the edge, and they become really in crisis. And oftentimes, 80% of the time, they're becoming actively suicidal.
So even though this anger may have been festering over some time, it usually takes that one thing to push them over the edge.
Right. There's kind of a final thing that really sends the person into crisis. And it's oftentimes a noticeable crisis. So people will notice a shift in their behavior. And then what you see is people find something to focus on as the grievance, something to blame for this crisis that they're in.
You say that they often are suicidal. Many times when we talk about the signs to look for when someone may be contemplating ending their life, you know, we will maybe recognize those things or maybe afterwards look back and say, I saw some of the signs. But not everyone, in fact, very few people go out and commit a mass shooting. So how is someone to recognize the difference?
You know, I don't know that you always can. And part of when we talk about, you know, what could suicide prevention do to prevent mass shootings, it would also prevent suicide, which are a much bigger problem. And of course, the vast majority of people who are suicidal would never dream of doing a mass shooting. But we do know that these mass shootings are intended to be suicide. People don't do them and then have an escape route planned. They plan for this to be their final act. So if we can catch some of those signs earlier, intervention is possible. And maybe we are just intervening in a potential suicide, and that's great too if we can sort of prevent those as well.
You mentioned validation, and what many of the mass shooters have done is study the actions of other mass shooters. Why have they done that?
You know, I think this is where the societal piece gets involved, the more sociological factors. So we've seen an uptick in these, and we see that they're socially contagious, so they tend to occur in clusters. Individuals study what others have done, become inspired by them, if you will. So, for example, when you look at school shooters, about half of them are based on or have some relationship with the Columbine shooting. They study it, sometimes they even visit there, they read diaries, and there's other shootings that have done that where they've really inspired a lot of people afterwards. You also see individuals going online often to find validation for their angry ideas. So whether they've chosen to blame the school or their workplace or women or a certain racial group, you can go online and find these forums where other people are thinking the same way you do, and suddenly your ideas become validated. And people become radicalized pretty quickly in these online groups.
The fourth characteristic that you have found that all the mass shooters had is that they had a means to carry out their plans. Most people probably would think of guns right off of the bat, and that is just one part of it. But what do you mean that they had a means to carry out their plans?
Right. So there's two pieces to this. One being the weapons and having access to the weapons. And so for school shooters, the majority of them are taking them from their parents and their grandparents. For workplace shooters, the majority of them are using handguns that they legally own. For other types of shootings, they're more likely to buy assault weapons illegally. So it kind of varies looking at the different shooters. And then they also have access to their chosen target, so the ability to get in and actually do it.
This information that you have compiled, I mean, they're breaking it down to just four commonalities. There is a lot of questions that you have asked, and you've actually interviewed some of the school shooters. Give us a sense of the kind of information that you have compiled on mass shooters over the years.
So each person in our database is coded on 80 to 90 different life history factors. So this is everything from, you know, mental health, childhood, relationship with peers, parents, their past interests, how they use social media. Basically anything that anyone has ever thrown out is a predictor. We put it in the database. We also are looking at even community level variables. So how many mental health resources are in the community? How many gun stores are in the community? What's the unemployment rates, and so also looking at those pieces. So we're trying to create as complete picture as we can to really understand these trajectories. And then we're also conducting interviews. So we've interviewed seven, I believe, living incarcerated mass shooters, and then also talking to parents of perpetrators, siblings, high school friends, anyone who knew them, to try to get a better sense of how do you get to the point of doing this.
Thank you for listening to one of the top stories of 2019 on Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar.